smarterpodcasts.com, delivering sound advice.
We've done many programs on the Good Dog Podcast about various methods of training, but this particular method that Dale Stavroff has pioneered is of great interest to me. His book is called Let the Dog Decide, the revolutionary 15-minute-a-day program to train your dog gently and reliably. And Dale, I love those words, gently and reliably. It tells us a lot right off the top. Welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Tell me a little bit about your program, and of course we'll dive into the details as we move forward.
Okay, well, you know, I spent a lot of time. I kind of came up through the system that, you know, we all see as kids, which is what I call the sort of old kick-and-stick school of dog training. And, you know, you kind of emulate the people that you see around you, the trainers. And I was just convinced, especially after spending some time working with disturbed children and learning something about behavior, that there was a better way. And so when I came back from working with children, I started looking at the whole dog picture again and started developing ideas about how I could use the knowledge I'd gained working with children and apply that to working with dogs. And when you start to study the dog, and if you look at the studies of dogs, you'll find that the thing that interrupts the process of learning in dogs almost exclusively is fear. So when studies are done, it's found that, you know, dogs don't really have a limit to the process of learning. In other words, they don't sort of learn until they're 2 years old and then stop, or three. That isn't what happens. What happens is that fear kicks in, and when fear kicks in, we lose what's called willingness. When that process starts, the dog starts to go into avoidance. It starts to move away. It starts to, because of its discomfort, it wants to stay out of this uncomfortable zone. And our whole relationship with the dog begins to break down. The bond breaks down. Everybody loses.
It's very interesting. I mean, all of us who have dogs know they are so eager to please. And yet we're told time and again that fear is a great motivator. And fear is really the method that's used in a lot of training programs. But it is counterintuitive, I think.
That's exactly right. The fear stops. I mean, I think even if you look at people, fear stops learning. It just stops learning. It's what happens. And because the dog is given really a very simple ways of dealing with self-concern. Once a dog goes into defense, it can run away, which is avoidance. It can submit, you know, throw itself on the ground and, urinate and display submissive behaviors. Or it can attack. And that's it. That's what the dog has. And once a dog goes into defense, if you can sort of put yourself in the position of the dog or think about what it's like to be afraid, all thinking stops. All you're really trying to do is just get out of the situation. And that puts an end to learning right there.
So when you say afraid, they're afraid, obviously, that you're going to do something that will hurt them. But are they actually afraid of displeasing you?
Gee, that's a tricky one.
I guess it depends on the dog, right?
Yes, and there's a lot of thought around that issue. Let me put it this way. I see dogs as being similar to us in the sense that I ask myself, what does the dog want? Well, he wants access to the good things in life, rewards, just like we do. And he wants to escape discomfort, just like we do. Now, when he looks around himself, he's going to look for those circumstances or people that can provide him with the things that he wants in life. Now, if you present yourself as a person who brings him reward and safety and escape from discomfort, that dog's going to want to do almost anything for you. And in that regard, I think they are willing. I think they do want to do things for us. I think they want to know how the world works and how to get along. But once pain and fear come into the picture, that all starts to break down. And now they have to concern themselves with keeping themselves safe, and not safe from things that, an attack from another dog. They're actually now having to concern themselves with keeping themselves safe from us, and that's a very bad thing.
Well, it's stressful and it sets up a whole different situation. So, in fact, is the old adage, you can't teach an old dog new tricks, false?
Yes, it is. I get lots of dogs flown in here that are 3, 4 years old that have just been, they've been through 2 or 3 sets of training. They've been just completely disenfranchised. They're aggressive. They're angry. They're enraged. They're upset. And I can turn around those dogs no problem at all. I mean, the dog is looking for a way out. The dog, in a sense, no more wants to be depressed and unhappy and angry any more than we do. They want out of that circumstance. And if you show them how to get out of that state of mind and out of that circumstance, they will go for it.
So they need to learn to trust?
Yes, and the trust is, and that's a very, and that's also a very interesting way of putting it. For dogs, the way dogs keep themselves safe, if you watch the way dogs behave naturally with each other, they keep themselves safe through ritual. So when two dogs meet each other, we see a ritual. You know, they'll use certain gestures. One dog will gesture at the other dog gestures back, and they go through this sort of ritualistic behavior. And the reason why they go through that ritualistic behavior is to secure their safety. That's how they're managing the environment and they're managing the circumstance so that they can be safe. And if you look at training, which is what I do, I look at training as being teaching the dog rituals. We teach the dog, because the dog won't see training as training, because he has no concept of why we would want him to do anything. I mean, if I ask a dog to track, he has no idea why I want to find whatever it is that I'm trying to find. I mean, he's not engaged in it for moral and ethical reasons.
No, that's irrelevant to him.
That, absolutely it is. So what it becomes is, well, this is a ritual through which I can gain access to reward, and I can also escape any discomfort.
And so, it's fun for them, isn't it?
Absolutely it is. The happiest dogs I have ever seen are dogs with jobs. The working dog, even if he can't go, let's say you have a hunting style dog, even if you're not a hunter and you know, so you're not in it for that reason, if that's a dog who's taken out and taught to fetch, you know, and do a nice retrieve and do that, that's a happy dog. Dogs want things to do. Dogs want to feel that they're needed and that they're doing something valuable for you.
You know, I work at with Guide Dogs for the Blind. We're launching a guide dog podcast, and what you say is so true. These dogs who are so well trained and have a lifelong partnership with people are so happy, and it's just evident from looking at them.
That's right, and I mean the guide dog is the apex. It is the pinnacle of dog and man in my mind. No dog should be more respected and admired for giving himself, giving his whole life and himself to his master. That's I just admire those dogs to no end.
Absolutely.
And you're absolutely right. Having that job, having and taking that responsibility makes those dogs very happy.
It's really about teamwork, and many of us have that with our pet dogs, even if they don't have jobs per se. It's a partnership that enriches both parties. One of the things that you write about and clearly practice in your work training dogs is that you work with a dog's natural attributes. Tell me what some of those are.
Well, for example, if I have a if a dog has a predisposition towards a behavior, or let's say if a dog is dominant, and that's his profile, I don't try to change dominant dogs. I don't try to change the way sort of a dog is to get him to do something. What I do instead is encourage him to be who he is and keep his profile where he's comfortable and then use that those characteristics that he displays to help him to do his work. So I alter training and I change the flow of training to meet the individual dog's characteristics, his personality. So again, if I have a dog who's on the aggressive side, I can use more rough and tumble rewards, just as an example. If a dog is softer and sensitive, then I'll use softer, easier going methods. Do you see what I'm saying?
Absolutely. I'm chuckling because a lot of this is applicable to child raising as well.
That's exactly right. It isn't what's important here is that it isn't what we think. It isn't how we see things that matters. It's how the dog sees things. If we're the trainer, we're supposed to be, in a sense, kind of smarter than they are. And the object is to help the dog find his goal. And that's best done when we look at the world through the dog's eyes. When I go outside with a dog, what I need to do is to have empathy for that dog and try to see the world as he is seeing it, and that will give me the best clues as to how I should go about training him.
What are some of the characteristics or attributes of dogs in general that you take into account in advocating these training methods?
Well, drive levels are very important, and this is attached to willingness. Dogs with high drive levels are going to work hard. They're going to stay at a task, and that needs to be assessed. If you know that the dog has it and these attributes, then you're going to include that in your training plan. And you also know that that dog must be satisfied by training, which means that you, again, you may have to do extra things for that dog to make sure that his drives are satisfied. Same thing with a low-drive dog. If a dog comes in, he has low drive and low self-esteem, I'm going to try and help him become more active, more happy, raise his drive levels, raise his self-confidence. And so I'm looking at that as well. What is the dog's confidence? What are his drive levels? And, of course, what is his disposition? How quickly does he go into defense? How easily is this dog threatened? That's another very important thing that people don't recognize, and that is that if you approach dogs from a generic point of view, I mean, one dog you can kind of come up to and be fairly firm about that you don't want him to do this or that, and he just goes, okay. And he's not worried about that at all. And you approach another dog in exactly the same way, and he's trembling in fear. And I see this when I go to these group classes to observe quite often. I see these poor puppies all lined up in a row with these choke chains on. And some of them are taking it okay, but I see other dogs who are shivering, who are drooling, whose ears are flattened, whose eyes are squinted, their tails are down, and they're not taking this very well at all. And all that's happening here is that the bond is being broken down, and the trust the dog had is being broken down, and willingness is being lost.
Dale, what do you think of clicker training?
I like it. It's a low-stress, no-stress way of teaching a dog a behavior. Now, the thing that I don't like about it, if you could say, is that it's not training. They call it clicker training, but it is not training. It is a teaching method. Training, the word training, as defined, means that when you're done, the dog will do what it is that he is signaled to do, when he's signaled to do it, and he will not engage in behaviors that we do not want the dog to engage in. So we don't have a dog doing the trained behavior unless he's asked for it, and we don't have him engaging in behaviors that are destructive or problematic. So clicker teaching is an excellent low-stress way of showing a dog a behavior, having him enjoy the behavior, empowering the dog. I use it a lot with dogs who are nervous. I use it with dogs who have low self-esteem, low confidence. And it's an excellent method for teaching. However, it's not a training method. Therefore, you cannot get reliability from using a clicker. And that's the downside of it.
When you talk about this 15-minute-a-day program, really what you're talking about is 3 5-minute sessions. Tell us about that and what happens in this each of the sessions.
Okay, well, the learning is best achieved when there's fun and positive things going on. And this can be maintained for a short period of time. I mean, for us and for the dog, going on for any length of time starts to produce a kind of malaise. You know, you kind of start to drift off and you're not really focused. So when I take a dog out, first thing I do is when I bring the dog out is get the dog up in drive and play with him a little bit and let him know that we're about to have fun. And then I'll start to engage in whatever behavioral training I'm going to be doing in that session. And I want it over quickly. I want to teach one thing and one thing only. I'll go out, I teach this one thing. First, like I said, I get the dog up in drive, I get the dog happy, I teach the dog what it is I want him to know, and then I put an end to the session. This leaves the dog wanting more. It makes a huge impression on the dog that this one thing happened, that he was highly rewarded for that thing. Everything good that happened in that session happened around that one behavior.
And what do you do for the reward?
I'm heavily into, first of all, I use food rewards quite a bit. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to say, well, what gratifies a dog? Well, you know, you can scratch him and you can pet him. And I use that a lot, of course, and praise him up. But the things they like is something that tastes good just like we do. So I use food for rewards, especially when I want the dog calm and thinking. When I want the dog up and drive and acting powerfully, then I use the fetch, I'll use the tug, just about anything. Anything that I find that makes that particular dog happy, I'm going to use. There is no limit to what I will do with a dog. And sometimes, actually, and I talk about the dance of joy, sometimes with a dog, he does something particularly wonderful for me or breaks through on a particularly difficult behavior. I will run away from the dog, run across the lawn like a nut, and the dog will come taking off after me. I throw myself on the ground and start to roll around and put my hands over my head. The dog comes chasing after me and jumps on top of me and starts licking my face, and, you know, like, because he sees that I'm playing like a puppy. I'm being a goof.
That's great.
I will goof with this dog and just do everything I can to show him, sort of show him fun and play on his level. And that's a very powerful reward that I use with dogs. It works out wonderfully with them. So nothing is outside my purview in terms of reward. But fundamentally, when I'm teaching, calmly trying to teach a dog a behavior, I use food rewards. And I often use, if the dog is dominant, I will not use the clicker very much. The lower the dog status, the more I'll use a clicker in food.
What would you say, Dale, are the biggest mistakes that people make in attempting to train their own dogs? I think I could answer my own question. It's that they don't attempt to train their dogs.
Yes, there's number one.
That'd be number one.
I think that we have not been, we've been too much taught to look for the response. Like, in other words, if we go out and we say, we're trying to teach to sit, as an example, we get all caught up in whether or not the dog sat. So if the dog doesn't sit, then we tend to get frustrated, people get frustrated and upset, and this can be tied into their failure to assess their own dog's status and emotional state. And so now they go out, and they've been told and they believe that the most important thing to do here is to get the dog to sit, let's say. Well, I am not in the least bit concerned with getting a dog to sit. What I'm concerned with is state of mind and his disposition. Mood drives behavior. If a dog feels good about doing something, he will do it forever. And you can think of this in the same sense that you think of, how hard is it to get little boys to play baseball? Well, it's not hard at all because they love baseball and they enjoy playing baseball, so they want to play. You don't have to talk them into it. But how hard is it to get little boys to sit in a room and do math? Well, they don't want to do that. So we can see that mood drives behavior. If there's a good mood attached to a behavior, then any animal is willing to engage in it. If a poor mood or a negative mood is attached to behavior, any animal is going to be unwilling to give it. So people go out and they think they've been told by, you know, some trainers to, you know, make the dog do this, and the session is a failure unless the dog does it. To me, a session is a failure when the dog comes away indifferent or unhappy. If I don't get the sit today, I'll get the sit tomorrow. I'm not worried about that. What I'm concerned about is the dog's state of mind. We should all be thinking about the mood of the dog. You take your dog out to train. If your dog's tail is wagging and his ears are up, his eyes are round, his tongue's hanging out of his mouth, and he's looking at you like he loves you, you're doing the right thing. If his tail's down and his head is hanging, he's reluctant or he looks shied or concerned, you're doing the wrong thing. You'll get the sit in the end. Be patient. And I think that's the sort of the worst thing that people do is they don't assess their dog, and then they're driven by the system where they believe that if they don't get these behaviors to happen, that they have failed and that they're failing in training. And that's just not true.
Thank you so much for all of your time and for these insights, Dale. I want to let everyone know that you can get Dale's book, Let the Dog Decide, the revolutionary 15-minute-a-day program to train your dog gently and reliably. So, Dale, thanks so much for joining us today on Good Dog, and good luck in your training.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and it was very nice talking to you.